Daniel Lanois has emerged as one of the more interesting rock record producers of the late 1980s. His credits include the U2 albums The Joshua Tree and Unforgettable Fire, Peter Gabriel's So, Robbie Robertson's recent self-titled album, the Neville Brothers' latest, Yellow Moon, and Bob Dylan's new album, Oh Mercy, which has been described by many critics as Dylan's best album in years. Lanois learned a lot about synthesizers and electronic production techniques, working with composer and producer Brian Eno. Daniel Lanois grew up in Hull in the French-speaking northeastern spur of Canada. He didn't learn to speak English until his family moved to Hamilton, Ontario when he was 11. For the past couple of years, Lanois has worked out of a studio in New Orleans, a city that was settled by the French Acadians when they were expelled from Canada in the mid-1700s. Now Lanois has a new record of his own, his first album of his own songs. After creating a sound for so many other performers, I wanted to know how he came up with the sound for his own record, Acadie.
I did give that some thought, but some of the songs on the record are quite clear in their own direction. You know, they didn't need a lot of preconception or direction. You know, like a song like Jolie Louise, a melody like da 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 da. You know, it sort of creates its own path. You know, there's only so much you can do with a little tune like that.
Now let me ask you about your song, The Maker. This is, you say in the liner notes of the record that the song was superimposed on a drum track that was recorded for the Neville Brothers record, but this drum track wasn't used on that record, so you asked for permission to use it on the song. What was it about the drum track that made you want to take it back?
I really love these New Orleans rhythms, and Willie Green, the drummer who played that, is like one of the best drummers in New Orleans. And he had played this track for the song Voodoo on the Yellow Moon record, but we had chosen a different approach, and the track was never used, but it was always like the best drum track in a way. And isolated like from the song Voodoo, it just had this fantastic skipping, uplifting feeling. And I had hoped that someday I'd find a home for that track, and I kept it on the shelf. And I think I tried quite a few of my songs against that drum track just to desperately make it work.
But The Maker fit?
The Maker was most successful.
This record is four mixes done at four different times.
Yeah, it's
edited together.
It's a technique that I use. I don't use computers for mixing. So, what I will do is do a mix on a given day and document all the settings with a camera. And then if the mix needs to be changed, like let's say it's a great mix but the intro is not quite right, well, you can put up the same mix by using a recall on the camera and remix just an intro and cut it together like with a razor blade on tape. And then a few days later I might think, well, maybe the ending can be better. So it's a series of remixes spliced together on analog tape.
Is it hard to get a spontaneous feel to a record when there are so many mixes and so much editing involved?
Well, that's spontaneity is the reason why you do that, because maybe that first mix was a spontaneous mix and something was captured. And rather than junk it, I choose to repair it, you know, to do little cuts and incisions and to save, you know, that wonderful spontaneous foundation.
Now, I think the Maker is an interesting contrast to your song Jolie Louise, which is...
Well, I can help you with it.
Okay, yeah.
They're very different in the sense that Jolie Louise has a traditional sounding melody, and it's very underproduced. You know, it has maybe four components. You know, an accordion, a couple of guitars, drums, and bass, and it has sort of a timelessness because of it. The story is sort of timeless, and the approach is too. Now, The Maker, on the other hand, is quite modern in its production, anyhow. Very much unlike Jolie Louise.
Now, Jolie Louise sounds like all the musicians were together in the studio playing, which, of course, they weren't.
No, it ended up sounding like that, luckily. But and it should sound that way, you know, for that song. That track was initially laid down with my doing knee slap, which is just this kind of hand percussion on your lap, and Malcolm Byrne playing Wurlitzer piano, and a little time reference, like a little pulse. And the vocal was done live with the piano to this little pulse. And it always had like this really sweet and sour feeling to it that we managed to maintain throughout, like a very happy melody and with a very sad song.
Ma jolie, how do you do? Mon nom est Jean-Guy Thibault Leroux. I come from east of Gatineau. My name is Jean-Guy, ma jolie. J'ai une maison à La Fontaine, where we can live if you marry me. Une belle maison à La Fontaine, where we will live, you and me. Oh, Louise, oh, ma jolie Louise. Tous les matins au soleil, I will work till work is done. Tous les matins au soleil, I did work till work is done. And one day, the former said, Jean-Guy, we must let you go. Et puis mon nom est pas bon at the mill anymore. Oh, Louise, I'm losing my head, I'm losing my head. My kids are small, 4 and 3. Et la bouteille, she's mon ami.
I like the way the lines alternate between English and French. I was wondering if that's the way you think sometimes, having grown up in French-speaking Quebec and then moving at 10 or 11 to English-speaking Ontario. Do you still think a little in English, a little in French?
Well, even these days, I think in French. My months are in French, and I count in French. But it's also the way people speak in certain parts of Canada, you know, where, like, between Ontario and Quebec, where the these little communities, it's not quite defined whether they're French or English, and there's this kind of mixture, you know, and people will start speaking in French and then change into English to accommodate certain words.
You've been working out of New Orleans for the past few years, and I was wondering if being in a culture that is derived in part from French-speaking Canadians who emigrated down to New Orleans, if that's given you a new perspective on the French part of your background, both musically and culturally.
I was always interested in that migration, you know, the Acadians leaving the North and going to Louisiana. That's a fascinating story. But my visit to New Orleans was quite an innocent one. I was really, it was more of a musical adventure. I wanted to understand about the beats in that part of the world, but so there was not, you know, a great Acadian connection for me. That's not why I went there. In fact, you have to go west to really be exposed to the Cajun culture. It's in Lafayette rather than New Orleans.
Well, in New Orleans, you produced one of the best known New Orleans groups, the Neville Brothers. I was wondering how you try to maintain a balance of their sound, their almost jamming kind of sound, and your more, I think, kind of controlled approach to production.
I was really looking to maintain a good balance. for me, like one of the best records the Neville Brothers ever did is the Wild Chapatulas record, if you're familiar with that. It's quite a traditional record, you know. Their Uncle Jolly pushed them to make that record, and it's fantastic. And I thought if we could make a record as great as the Wild Chapatulas record, it would be quite a feat. As it turns out, we did not do a traditional record. The Neville Brothers are just not that interested in the traditional music anymore. They love it and everything, but they're just not doing that thing anymore. So we had to find a new exciting angle, a new direction. So we tried all sorts of techniques. I found that much of the arrangements that they had did not work so well in the studio, because it's a thing that in the excitement of a live performance, you know, like these quite long-winded arrangements work. But you get into the studio and you're presented with a few cliches that you must knock down. So we had to quite radically take some new approaches for songs like My Blood. And it was important for me to find like a new twist on that so that it didn't sound like a cliche.
And what was the twist you found?
I suggested that they build their song on top of a track that I already had in the library, something that Brian Eno and I started a long time ago. It was like 7 years old, this track, and it happened to be the same rhythm, the same pulse as My Blood. And it had this quite beautiful, ethereal atmosphere in the same key. So I suggested build a song around this, because it will take you to someplace unknown.
Neville Brothers performing My Blood from their latest album, Yellow Moon. You produced Bob Dylan's latest record. How did you prepare for working with him? Did you go back and listen to his other records again to get a sense of where he'd been up until this point and where the next step might be?
There are so many Bob Dylan records that it would take a year to to become an expert on them. I chose to listen to two or three records of his. One of his albums is called Desire, one of my faves. Also his first record, which I think is just called Bob Dylan, has some amazing songs on it. And I like the freedom of the guitar playing on that record. You know, it breaks in and out of time, you know, almost randomly to accommodate the lyrics and the vocal performance. So I guess I looked to those records as landmarks, but I was not so interested in studying his more recent records. You know, I'd heard rumors that they were not as special as some of his previous recordings, so I didn't want to be pulled down in any way. I wanted to remain optimistic and look to the greatest work as a standard.
Now, I want to play the track most of the time, and I feel like I can hear your production on this. Tell me about what you were doing on this song.
Most of the time, Bob played me that song on piano, just him on piano and singing it. I paid him a visit at his house, and I recorded a version of that in that simplicity, and I lived with that simple rendition of it for so long that I was very attached to it, and I fell in love with the phrasing of that rendition, and I really wanted quite specifically to repeat that, you know, and not have too much around it. So it's essentially the same vocal approach, but in the end I decided to undermine it with these strange, distorted, distant guitars, you know, like almost like with the, like a Sweet and Sour thing again, because the song is saying, like, most of the time I'm clear focused all around, most of the time I can keep both feet on the ground. It's like you've said all of these things, how confident you are, but then, you know, at a moment of weakness, you think about the person that you really need. And I really want to somehow make that weakness evident in the distance.
Most of the time, I'm clear focused all around. Most of the time, I can keep both feet on the ground. I can follow the path, I can read the sign. Stay right with it when the road unwinds. I can handle whatever I stumble upon. I don't even notice see gone most of the time.
Dylan has a rough voice. It's not a polished voice. Is there a different way you'd produce someone like that than you would someone who has, you know, like, you know, perfect pitch and, you know, a beautiful voice?
The best way to deal with a rough voice is to make it rough and to put it in the foreground. And that's what I tried to do on this Bob Dylan record. His voice is not tucked under the rug, you know. It's like in your face. You can hear the whiskiness of it, the breathing, all the words. I like that in his voice, and I think it comes through in the record.
You started off when you were living in Canada with a production facility in your basement that I think you and your brother built. And that's where you met Brian Eno, who did some production work there. What brought him there?
The studio started out really small. It was like, it was nothing. It was like in the recreation room of my mother's house, and we hit like every step of the ladder, you know, the 2-track, 4-track, 8-track, and whenever we had any kind of cash, you know, from work, we would just sink it right back into equipment. And eventually we moved out of the basement and started this pretty nice studio called Grant Avenue Studio. It was like a family-run restaurant, you know. And we did a lot of productions in there, and one of those productions made its way to New York. These people called the Time Twins brought a tape to Brian Eno and played him this tape. And he was really blown away by the strangeness of the approach, and he said, who made this tape? You know? And they said, well, there's this Canadian guy that you might like to work with. And so Brian phoned up and just booked time out of the blue. It's quite an innocent little tale, you know.
I want to end with the last track from your new record. And this is a version of Amazing Grace, sung by Aaron Neville of the Neville Brothers. I guess it's something he recorded for the Neville Brothers record that you produced. Why wasn't the track used on their record?
I was doing some demos with the Neville Brothers, and we tried a lot of things. You know, we tried Listening Wind by the Talking Heads, which is a great song. Never got used. We tried Amazing Grace, a dozen different things. And Amazing Grace was always a staggering performance, and it was almost a cappella. Art was holding organ chords down, but they were more like for pitch reference. And Aaron was in the other corner of the room singing this Amazing Grace, and it brought tears to my eyes when I heard this, and I thought, we must use this somewhere. But the Neville's record was already a little bit weighed down at the quiet end, so it would have put it off balance. So we chose to leave it off, and I started experimenting with this Amazing Grace, thinking that I might use it on my record. And I like the strange and interesting rendition that we have. It's like Amazing Grace being sung in the future.
Well, there's a lot of interesting electronic effects here that I think you couldn't have used on a Neville Brothers record. It isn't their sound at all. It's your sound.
It would have been too ethereal, I think, for them, not representative of what they do.
And this is one of the times when you have Neville mixed in the background. You know, it sounds very distant, the vocal.
Yeah, it just worked best that way. When I mixed his vocal far away, it sounded like somebody trying to reach you, trying to communicate a message, but from a place very far away, and almost like they're rediscovering this ancient folk song and singing it for the first time. And it sounds like it's coming through a shortwave radio.
Great. Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.